Jim was able to locate this reader. She was our second pleasant surprise of the event. This is Faith Bemis. She's a published poet, and she'll be reading at the Montserrat Poetry Festival this year. And she has a book available. It's a hybrid of both poetry and original photography. And I would like to talk a little bit about Faith. Faith Bemis, an award-winning fine art photographer, is a native of Sedalia, Missouri. With a love for the outdoors, she began her career by targeting national gardening magazines. Her first published piece became the cover of a newly formed national gardening magazine titled Birds and Blooms, published by the former Raymond Publications, now Reader's Digest Milwaukee. Since that time, her work has appeared in several national and regional magazines, including Flower and Garden, Missouri Life, National Gardening, The Ozarks Mountaineer, Victorian, and The Lake Magazine. She and her husband, Roy? I was hoping you'd be Roy. Oh, gosh. travel together during out-of-state photo shoots. Together, they enjoy rising early and hiking the canyons and desert areas of Utah and Arizona. A spiritual person, Faith enjoys the solitude and quietness of nature, especially the Red Rock Canyons and narrow slot canyons of Utah and the poetic rock formations of the Vermilion Cliff Wilderness area of southern Utah and northern Arizona. She has enjoyed writing poetry since high school, and this here is her first book of poetry, and many of those scenes I described are sure to be in there. Great. So please give it up for Faith.
Can you hear? Oh, there it is. Okay. Thank you very much for asking me to come. Since the first book of poetry, I've started delving into some more deeper poems, and some of them deal with social issues. I did pick a couple lighter ones to read tonight, and I do have one that's a little more heavy. But the first one I'm going to begin with is called Mama's Hair, and I got to thinking about my mama's hair and how it changed over the years, and it's just kind of a little bit of a lighthearted tribute to her and her hair. And it's in big print, so I can read it. Mama's hair. Mama's hair used to be brown. My first memory of her is being rocked in her arms, nuzzled against the comfort of her big bosom, while she sang an off-tune lullaby, her short brown hair crowning her head. When I was three, Mama dyed her hair black. She took one look in the mirror and she said, "Oh God, what have I done?" She promptly bleached it out, not thinking her hair might fall out. It didn't. She was lucky. When I was four, she left her worldly ways and joined the church. She got saved. No more dyeing, bleaching, and cutting her hair away. She let it grow and grow and grow till it stopped way down her back. Now a new problem arose: how to fix such long hair. She devised a plan. She created a rat. Made with her hair, saved from a brush, it became a removable bouffant, a portable poof. Scooping up her now stilly gray hair into a ponytail, she'd flip it upside down onto the hairy little rat she'd created and pin it in place. It looked quite like a cow flop. But she was proud of her self-inspired top. And as time went on, I grew older. I decided the cow flop had to go. So from a teenager until she reached her 70s, I maintained Mama's hair. Once, twice, sometimes three times a week, I spun her now pearly white hair into a lovely crown, still using that homemade rat to give it some height. Over time, her arms became heavy and weary, and washing the snowy white strands became impossible for her. So the weekly hairstyling also included shampoos. And soon my daughter grew old enough to maintain her dues. Maintaining her hair became a generational tradition. She wasn't about to cut it. The good book said you shouldn't. And besides, it was such a pretty mane, it would have been a shame. In the fall, in the winter of her life, she took to her bed and fell asleep one final time. We chose her dress, the bright purple one, with the fashionable jacket and the satin detailing down the side. But alas, what did the undertaker know about Mama's long hair? He'd never perfect her pearly strands. That was a task only for my daughter and I. The final farewell, the cherished goodbye. We descended those steps where Mama lay and combed her hair, styled away, perfecting each and every pearly white strand, scooping her hair into a snowy pompadour. One last final tribute to Mama, her hair, and that perennial rat. And she actually did have a great big white pompadour. I looked it up, and that's what they wore back in the 1700s, I believe. But it was white pompadour.
Across the street was where she bleached her hair.
Yeah. We used to live at 2nd and Ohio up here. Well, my second selection is a little more thought-provoking, and I wrote it due to an injury our oldest son had in Iraq. He was injured in Iraq, came home and was convalescing, and then was in a car accident stateside and broke his neck. While in the VA system, he was just about killed by the VA system and the doctor there. This happened at the same time as Walter Reed and all the fiasco with the healthcare. The young men were coming back, and instead of like in Vietnam where a lot of them were killed, they now had the, what's it called, the vests. So they were being spared, but they were coming back maimed, burnt. And the VA system became overwhelmed. They didn't know what to do with all these young men because they were used to dealing with the older men. And now they had a new generation of wounded. And our son began to fall between the cracks. And this is a poem that I wrote in my anger at the system. It's called The Healing World. The darker nature of the healing world, hidden down corridors behind closed doors, where wounded soldiers are stashed and stained on healing in their wounds, seeping sickness no one can cure. TV crews tour the immaculate halls reporting hasty cures and miracles never seen behind the wall in the darkness. A young man lays thin and shrunken, tubes in play, infection creeping, the dirty secret no one can heal. Helpless in a paralyzed body broken by war, a hero saving our country, now forgotten in a stagnant pool of politics and rhetorical power. Laying in a bed, tubes sprouting from his neck. No food or water by mouth, the doctor says. Not until I heal this gnawing hole in his neck. She presses her healing hands together in assurance that he'll survive. But 16 months go by. Incision after incision she tries. Hands bloody with a hero's wounds. She's prepared to cut until he dies. Stalwart in her professional stance. Confident she has the knowledge to grant another chance. Nurses hang their heads and whisper, "Get him out." While the government stalls, trying to close the exit routes. Sweep it under where the darkness lies in the moldy corridor of mistakes and research. In the name of society's betterment, a few must die so many can live. Sweep him under where all the other secrets lie. Bloodied hands, dripping patterns in the evening sun, in this place where wounded soldiers come to find healing among their countrymen. They should be safe from agendas and plans. How many must suffer, wither, and die, forgotten behind the wall, the closed doors, behind the whispers of a few chosen to read the filed reports? War never changes. It's always the same. Not about lives saved or lost, but about power about political gain. It's strange how the heroes change from the dusty soldier dodging firefights and roadside bombs to the men and women in the alabaster halls and domed cathedrals with silver tongues and velvet walls. The darker nature of the healing world, unprepared, untrained, unskilled to touch the young wounded, the brave, and the strong. The healers turn their hearts, their backs to the soldiers' cries, to work on genetic research, to win, to be recognized. They are knighted with accolades and ribbons, while the real hero dies. Our son Chris did survive. We wrote letters to the White House and senators, and we were able to get him transferred to Mayo Clinic, where they did one surgery on his throat, and they repaired it, and he was able to eat again, and he went home in 2 months and began physical therapy. Today, he drives, and he's still in a wheelchair, but he plays wheelchair rugby for a national team and is going back to college to get a degree in criminal justice. So we're just thankful that he made it. We're thankful he made it. This is on a lighter note, and it's about a childhood reminisce about a little old woman that came to church when I was a kid. And we may all relate to that. We called her Hawkeye because she was always after the kids. So names and places have been changed to protect the innocent. Anyway, Hawkeyed Agnes. Now, Sister Agnes was a steely, spindly woman who wore gray matron clothes and black lace-up shoes. She sat ramrod straight in her wooden pew, face toward the front, three rows back on the left. She took no flack from adults or kids. And if you sat close enough and talked enough during the holy worship hour, she'd thump you on the head with a withered paw, stare you straight in the eye, and say, "Mash that mouth shut." She had eyes in the back of her gray braided hair, and her peripheral vision wasn't impaired. No matter how hard you tried to pull one on her, she was never fooled. She became a legend of that white block church known as the Hawk-Eyed Sister, but her eyes never worked in duel. We knew she could move them separately, like a lizard looking for its prey. One eye looking straight ahead at the preacher so reverent, while the other scanned the crowd, looking for some unfortunate child who was too loud. Then her eyes would focus on that one causing disruption, staring them down until a shiver ran through their souls. And they knew they were destined to be ratted out. Nothing hurt worse than to see that eye boring a hole, since you knew she'd tattled to mama before the amen was cold. And no matter how hard you tried to explain, Hawkeye was always right. Explaining made you look insane. The preacher would confirm her worth by praising her longevity from the pulpit's girth. Sister Agnes rarely grinned, though, mainly due to her wobbly dentures that moved out quite ceremonially in and out. And on those fleeting rare occasions when a smile flashed by, all the kids knew she'd tried to use some type of super glue, since the teeth were nicely coated with a grungy finish of stringy, durable goo. Although this evil hawk-eyed woman could cause nightmares in some small children, everyone noticed when she was absent from her perfunctory pew. And the day came when the church bus came back empty. Sister Hawkeye Agnes didn't answer her door. All the members speculated this saintly woman must be sick. We'll send her flowers and soup and cards and letters, and soon she'll be up and fit. It never happened. Because when all those good meaning people arrived at her door, they were met by the police, who were checking out the place. Seems Sister Agnes had completely disappeared without a trace. Some of the holy congregation said she was spirited away by angels. Others said she was a man in disguise. Still others said she was abducted by aliens, no less. And then some of the most holy thought she was running from the law. Now I look back and see Hawk-eyed Agnes taught me so much, not to wiggle and talk and snort in church. But the most important lesson I learned, if something bad happens in some unjust hullabaloo, the church people will darn well toot and think the worst of you. Thank you.